Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. It is actually our 175th episode, so thank you for joining us for that special occasion. Of course, if you have any feedback or you just want to get in touch, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Well, of course, we have an exciting show for our 175th with two amazing guests, so it is time to get started. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
I am. I'm ready.
Perfect. Let me introduce you. James William Rose IV is probably better known to you all as America's Sweetheart, the fabulous and fierce Tyra Sanchez, winner of season 2 of RuPaul's Drag Race. And if you watched that season as avidly as I did, you know that he's also the proud father of the adorable Jeremiah. And now their relationship will be the subject of an upcoming documentary film called Drag Dad, which we want you all, our loyal listeners and our new listeners, to help fund. James, a.k.a. Tyra, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me.
What a treat. What is going on with you? How are things?
Things are a never-ending roller coaster. I've been going through so many obstacles, so many fun times, and just having a great time. Everything has been kind of overwhelming, but it's been fun.
You like the roller coaster.
I love the roller coaster. I love the roller coaster.
Love it. Well, we have tons to talk about. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, we should probably start off talking a little bit about RuPaul's Drag Race. RuPaul's Drag Race, James, a life-changing experience for you, or just this thing you did for a few weeks a few years ago that you kind of sort of remember?
I think it's life-changing for me.
Yeah.
Because I can never forget it. I can never let it go. It's always going to be here. It's the start of Tyra Sanchez in the mainstream industry.
I would imagine the feedback has just been nothing short of overwhelming.
Oh, it's been amazing. It's been great. I mean, of course, there are some that don't agree with it, but then there are 10 times more who love it. So, you know, to hell with the others.
Yeah. Now, you are the first queen from season 2. We have had over the years, I feel like we've specialized in queens from season 1. How did your season, would you say, differ from, you know, it's different when you're on a show, coming into a show that's already started. So you knew a little bit about the show before you went on. How did you guys all carve out your own way, knowing that you had to set yourselves apart?
I think I went in just being myself. I know I went in with a purpose, and that I had a goal to win, and that I had to get back home to my son.
Yeah.
So I didn't really like let any of the other things around me affect me as far as like the other queens or the other attitudes and like the, I don't know, what would you call it, the chaos in the room.
Right.
I didn't really let it get to me. I just stayed focused, and I stayed on the path that was meant for me.
Now, what does the title of America's Sweetheart mean to you?
America's Sweetheart to me means that I'm very sweet. Like, I'm the sweetest person, the most loving person that you could probably ever meet.
Nice.
But I'm still real. I still tell you the truth. I kind of give you tough love, but in a softer way. I help empower people and encourage people to be themselves and to step out of their shells. Actually, I meet a lot of people that remind me of myself back in high school, that the ones that got bullied, the ones that were the nerds that were shy and always quiet but wanted to live and was too afraid to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of, I just teach it to them now to get rid of it instead of waiting to the last minute. And, you know, you never know what could happen once it gets too serious.
Totally. Totally. Well, one of the things that America and people all over the world loved about you on that second season was that more than anyone else, and I think RuPaul said this many times, and the judges said this many times, that we could see you evolving, that you ended up just the most, you were already so poised, but we could see you evolving over the season, just gaining confidence and just standing so much taller. Did you feel yourself changing, evolving as the episodes went on?
Back then, no, I didn't. I felt myself becoming more determined.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at watching it now, I can't really make it through a couple of the first couple of episodes. I can't make it through. So, like, I haven't watched the season that I was on. I mean, I watched it with the viewing parties.
Okay.
But I've never been able to watch it alone to where I can actually pay attention to everything that's going around without anyone, like, saying anything to me.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like going to the movies. Like, you go to the movies to be quiet so you can pay attention to the movie. So I haven't gotten to the movies yet. I can't really make it through the first couple of episodes because I don't like my attitude. I don't like the person that I am. And it kind of just pisses me off, I would say.
Yeah.
So I don't get to see what everyone else sees. And a couple of my fans have told me that before, that they see this certain type of person. And I'm kind of afraid that if I see that person, that I wouldn't feel human anymore. You know what I mean? I wouldn't feel down to earth anymore, that I would be too proud, or I would be, you know what I mean?
Totally. Well, I think it was an amazing thing to behold. It just showed everyone that you were someone who was open to change, that you were taking in feedback, that you did have that determination to keep going. So even though you're not going to watch it, I've watched it for you, and it's awesome to watch.
Okay. Everyone tells me that. I'm trying to make it through. I'm trying. I'm going to try to make it through another episode. I promise I'm going to try to make it through another episode.
We have it down for you. You don't have to. I'm telling you, just take it from everyone else. You could just say, I don't need to waste my time. Everyone's telling me it's great to watch.
It's great to watch.
There you go. There you go. Well, let's talk about the unbelievably adorable, who I have seen in clips. How cute is that, Jeremiah?
Jeremiah is really cute, and he knows it. That's the problem.
Oh, no.
And he takes advantage of it sometimes. He's really a character. I think sometimes he probably watches too much TV.
Okay.
But he knows how to work a crowd of people.
Nice.
To get what he wants.
Okay.
At an early age, which is kind of crazy. He knows when and where to try things, and I guess I would say he knows the difference between good and evil now. He understands it.
Okay.
And he used it to his advantage. He knows when he's wrong, so he definitely knows that, but he also knows when he can get away with things now.
All right. Well, that's a developmental stage in itself. That's something. Now, to back up a step, I know you told this story when you were on the show, but for folks who are catching up a little late, you ran into some rough times when you were 17, did you not?
Mm-hmm. When I was 17, I became homeless, and I didn't have a place to stay. I actually was staying in a hotel with my son's mother.
Okay.
And we just, I don't know how to explain it, we were like literally like best friends and just hung out with each other.
Okay.
And grew closer from that.
And then Jeremiah entered the picture.
Yep. Jeremiah actually, that was one of the reasons why we weren't able to, we were homeless.
Okay. And so it was that process and that experience that led you to be a very young father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was through all of that kind of forced me to grow up.
Gotcha.
And forced me to literally like just stop being a child.
Gotcha.
And just growing up very, very fast.
Unbelievable. That's an incredible experience. Now, how did it come about that you have these directors coming to you and saying, hey, James, we want to film you. We want to document this relationship for a movie.
It came, Jeremiah and I did a short film a couple of months ago for Spiritualized Hey James.
Okay.
When we did the film, it got on, they put it on YouTube and it was really good. It got out to a lot of people, and then the director Bjorn saw it from there, and he approached me about doing the documentary Drag Dad, and I thought it was amazing that one thing that Jeremiah and I did together led to something bigger for me and Jeremiah to do together.
Did you have cameras following you around for a long period of time?
In New York, it was probably for about like a week.
Okay.
Then we're going to finish filming. Once the film is funded, we're going to continue on with it. And then I think it's just going to be amazing and crazy.
Yeah, that sounds incredible.
I'm excited about it.
We've already heard that Jeremiah is perhaps a little bit of a ham. He likes the limelight. Was he totally cool with it? How did you explain to him, listen, there's going to be some cameras filming us?
I asked him first, did he want to do a movie? And his response was, is it going to be my movie? Yeah, I was like, yeah.
Oh, you know you're in trouble when you get that response.
Yeah. He's a bit of he loves the limelight. He asked me the other day, could he have a Facebook so he could see how many fans that he has.
Oh, no.
He's dying to have his own website. I promised him I would build it for him because I could handle a website more than Facebook itself. I don't mind him having a website to where he wants to do like I don't know if you ever saw iCarly before.
Oh, yeah.
It's a TV show on Nickelodeon. He wants something like that. And so I'm probably just going to do it on my website and allow him to be a part of it. And just like kind of, cause I don't know about the Facebook. That kind of tripped me out.
Yeah.
I don't even know about Facebook, but.
He's going to be walking down the street looking for his own paparazzi.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. We went to Universal Studios a couple weeks back and we got stopped a few times and Jeremiah just hopped right in front of the camera.
Nice.
Before we could even get everyone in the picture, he hopped right in front of the camera. So he kind of loves it. He wants his own show on Disney Channel. So I guess it's just working out in his favor.
Oh man, this is going to be a real treat to watch that evolution. We've already watched your evolution. This is going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you hope happens with the film? What are your goals in doing the film? Obviously, we want everybody to see it and we want everybody to fund it. And we're going to provide the link right on our website. And so folks will click on the link and we need you guys to donate to help enable this project. So apart from just making the film and getting people to see it, what effect do you hope the film has?
I'm hoping that it changes a lot of views on parenting, on gay parenting itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to, I don't mean it in a way that, oh, gay parents are better than any other parent. I mean it in the way that we are all equal to each other, that we are all just the same. We all go through things. We all experience things together. We all grow together. There's not really much a difference between us.
Right.
And I really want that to be the main goal, that everyone can understand that and see that, and that everyone can also get to see James and Jeremiah in a different light. Of course, they'll get to see Tara, but, I mean, it'll introduce to them two new people, two great people, two amazing people, I should say.
Yeah. Now, is Tara performing these days? Are there places we can go see Tara?
Tara is performing. This upcoming month, she'll only be in Orlando, Florida. She'll be performing at the Parliament House.
Okay.
And then in September, she will be in Chicago and New York.
Nice.
And you can also find her on the cruise at Alan Check That Travel. She will be doing a cruise this December, from December 2nd through December 9th. And they are going many places. Very fun. You can have a private cocktail party with Tyra.
Wow.
With Tyra, and then just a private event with her. So it's really going to be fun.
When is Tyra coming up to Vermont? Has Tyra made her Vermont debut yet? I don't think so.
Tyra has not made her Vermont debut yet, but I definitely will look into that and have that set up.
We're ready.
I'll get my team on it and have it happen.
We're ready. Well, look, I love this project. I was so happy to hear from the whole team working on the documentary because I'm so excited to see it. There's so much to see. You know, it'll be great to, of course, see Tyra, but to know that there will be this relationship depicted on film that we don't always get the chance to see. And even just seeing the couple minutes mm-hmm. of teaser footage just shows, all right, why aren't we highlighting these relationships? Because this is a part of the fabric of our community, and we need to be depicting these stories. So I'm so appreciative that both you and Jeremiah, although it doesn't sound like it took much convincing for Jeremiah, have agreed to be a part of a project like this. I think it really is going to make a difference, James.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
So we are going to link right on our website to the Kickstarter page because we're coming towards the end of this donation cycle and we want to get this film funded. So what do you have to say to people to get them to give some money to support this project?
What would I say? I would say dig deep in your pockets, dig deep in your heart, and donate whatever you can to make this film possible, to not only change the lives of the viewers, but the lives of the viewers that's to come, because the film is going to be around forever. It's not just going to be a one-time thing. This is going to be something that's going to be passed down from generation to generation. It's just like the new Color Purple.
Nice. Nice.
I would say, like a movie that gets passed down from family to family to teach. Like, it's kind of like the Lean on Me that we saw at school, or movies that they showed at school.
Yeah.
It's like that.
I love it. Sixth period, what are we doing, social studies class? Oh, we got to watch Drag Dads. I see that coming up. I would love it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, folks, click on the link. Give deep in your pockets. Make this project happen because, again, we talk about this every single week of this show, and this is the 175th episode that we have said this. We want to highlight voices that are not currently being highlighted, because when we highlight these different voices, there's more power for everybody. James, Tyra, all of our best to Jeremiah. We want to make this project happen.
Oh, thank you so much. That really means a lot. Oh my God.
you keep on performing.
I'm smiling from ear to ear.
Good. We love making you smile. It's a treat having you on the show. We'd love to have you back. You keep performing. Tell Jeremiah we say hi. You know, we'll shine the spotlight on him anytime he wants it.
Okay.
Although I would say, yeah, no to the Facebook page.
Yeah, no Facebook.
James, Tyra, all the best. Keep on doing what you do.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, and we are back. I say we keep the fun times. Let's just keep them on rolling. Let's welcome Kelly Dunham to the show. Hey, Kelly.
Hi, how you doing?
Let me introduce you. Kelly Dunham is everyone's favorite ex-nun, genderqueer author, and nerd comic. We're going to deconstruct all of those words in a few minutes. She released her first CD, I Am Not a 12-Year-Old Boy, in 2005, and since then, it has been in regular rotation on Sirius Radio's mainstream comedy channel. She released her second CD, Almost Pretty, live from the Stonewall Inn in July of 2008, and it flew off the shelves and earned rave reviews. She was the winner of the 2007 Fresh Fruit Festival Award of Distinction for stand-up comedy. Her writing has been syndicated nationally, received several Vice Versa awards, and is regularly featured in Curve magazine. She's authored 4 books, and now she's put her skateboard down for a few minutes to spend some time on this, our 175th episode. Kelly Dunham, welcome to this show is So Gay.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Kelly, I am the dean of students at a college, and one of the areas that falls under my purview is career development. And I was thinking, as I was putting together your bio, you would either be the best career development specialist or not. And I can't tell which one.
You mean because I've had many varied careers? Is that what you mean?
You've had a couple careers, Kelly.
You know, I once, I started out, my first attempt at college was Mid-America Bible College, which was, as you can imagine, was really a great fit for me. And then later on, when I went to nursing school, I remember, handing my transcript to, the evaluator, the person who's there, and she said, seems like you're on an interesting career path. Because all my classes were like survey of the Old Testament, survey of the New Testament, systematic theology, Proverbs and Psalms, it makes sense if you live in my head, it makes sense. I guess that's always true, right? But you know, when people are like, well, how did you get from a, like, you know, non and extremely conservative order to a, like, queer stand-up comic? And to me, it seems like the most natural progression at all. And I would say that, like, you know, being a stand-up comic, you know, traveling itinerant stand-up comic is kind of like, you know, it's like the convent. It's just like, you know, less praying and more sex. So
there you go.
But see, it feels, to me, it feels pretty similar, you know.
Well, let's just say for the sake of it, let's treat this as a job interview, as all phone calls should be, and I'm interviewing you to be one of our new career development specialists. What would you tell a young student coming out of college in how to approach their journey?
Huh, that's an interesting interview question, one I've never had before.
I'm all about that.
Wait, when did you become a nun? Do nuns wear underwear?
Well, we'll get there. Trust me, we'll get there. It's just you have had this journey where a lot of people, as you said, would look at your journey and say, whoa, I could never do that. What would you say to others who want to embark on such a journey of following their passions?
Well, I mean, the thing for me is when I left the convent, I knew I needed to do, well, you know, I had $75 to my name and kind of like three ill-fitting shirts. And so I knew I needed to do something.
Okay.
I knew that this was not a, you know, obviously. So and I knew I wanted to go back to school. And both writing and performing have always been a part of my life. But, you know, there's really not, you know, there's kind of a select few that can make a comfortable living with that. I mean, some people make a fantastic living. But I also knew that I wanted to do these things. I wanted to write about things I wanted to write about, and I wanted to write about things that I felt like were important and make comedy about things that I felt like were important. And that's not always going to be the biggest commercial success. That's just not the way it works. So
right.
What I really wanted was a career that I could, that was flexible. And this is something I've actually been talking about with people in Brooklyn. Just had a conversation yesterday about, like, what careers are flexible and mixed with art? Because it used to be, back in the day, that you could, oh, I'll get a you know, a tenured job eventually.
Right.
You know? I'll teach. And that's not really, those same kind of jobs are not as open, right? And then often you end up living perhaps in a place that doesn't really work. For example, for having a performing career. So for me, nursing is an occupation that has a tremendous flexibility. There's a lot of different jobs you can do within nursing. There's a lot of different ways, you know, because I, like, for example, the books that I've written are all healthcare related, and they're also funny, so kind of mixing the two there. And then I've, you know, done everything from home visiting work to, like, public health outreach to, you know, I'm working in a long-term care facility, and all those had really often flexible schedules. And so for me, it's kind of a way of making a life. It's a way of making a life as an artist that makes sense. I mean, I tell people all the time, like, go into professions where you have a specific skill set and it's flexible. Like, to me, the way to be a writer is to be a nurse first. I tell people that all the time.
Nice.
Or electrician or a plumber. The other day I told somebody to be a plumber, and they kind of looked at me funny, and they're like, I think plumbers touch poo. And I was like, well, nurses touch poo as well.
there's the baseline.
I guess so, but for me it's worked really well. I'm so grateful, actually. And also the other thing is, you know, there is, I mean, for me, performing is a job. It's a great job, and I'm so lucky to have it as a job. I mean, I'm, you know, in, like, surprised and full of joy of my life almost every day.
Nice.
But it is also a job, right? It's a thing where you show up on time and you come and you work and then you go home. But there is that kind of sense of, I don't know if it's exactly entitlement or, like, preciousness that sometimes performers get, because, you know, you go on stage, you do your job, and everyone claps for you. And that's very lovely. I mean, if my accountant, who's very good at doing my taxes, went on stage and did, you know, he did his job, everyone would clap for him too. It's just that you're doing your job in front of other people. But I think that can give you kind of this elevated sense of self.
Yeah.
That I don't actually think I don't think it's great for your relationships with other people. And for me, like, the baseline is, am I making the world a better place?
Yes.
And so I feel like there's a certain way you have to be in the world to actually make that choice. So for me, being a nurse, you know, I can be all like, oh, I can't believe that person didn't laugh at my joke, or it was a quiet night at the club, or, you know, nobody showed up at this show that I traveled 6 hours to do. And then the next day, you know, you're talking with a teenager about their HIV status. You know,
right.
It kind of, like, reminds you of what's really important and what's really a tragedy. And it's not having somebody not laugh. That's not actually a tragedy.
Right. Let's go back to the first line of this bio, because we got to define some of our terms just to get everybody on the same page. We want to make sure we're all together on this. We covered it briefly. Everyone's favorite ex-nun. How did the ex-nun thing? Do people really come up to you and ask you, do nuns wear underwear and other nun-like questions?
They absolutely do. And in fact, I have always had the line, everyone's favorite ex-nun. And in fact, I handed my card to somebody the other day, and they're like, oh, you're not my favorite ex-nun. My aunt is my favorite.
But there's competition.
Like, do I need an asterisk? Like, I just thought, like, I could say, you know, I'm the everyone's favorite ex-nun. But apparently this guy thought that I should really know that I was not his favorite ex-nun. He, like, totally put me in my place. So maybe it should just be with all the... Somebody suggested that I just put hyphens in between all of that, so it's all just a description of me, because I probably am, you know, probably the only ex-nun, you know, stand-up, gender career stand-up comic. So if I put hyphens, it would just mean that I'm that particular person, so therefore I would be everyone's favorite, right? But, so the ex-nun, yes, people do ask me about nun underwear, and in fact I'm doing, for the last time ever, I swear, I'm doing Bad Habit, which is a one-person show about... my journey to the convent and getting kicked out. I'm doing that this week in New York, two shows only. And I'm actually, as the postscript to the show, I'm taking questions either from people that have submitted online or in person to answer all the questions that everyone is always asking me about being a nun, so I can get all that out there.
I feel like such a bad interviewer that the underwear question didn't even occur to me.
Yeah, well, maybe you just don't read enough ex-nun porn? I don't know. I don't know exactly how that
I can safely say that I do not read enough ex-nun porn. I, without doubt, as a gay Jew from Jersey, no question that that is not in my repertoire.
It never even occurred to you.
No.
Right?
Who knew?
Well, you know, people are very interested in the details of nun life because it's a life we don't know.
Right.
So I think that's why I kind of the question is like, oh, and most people haven't ever met an ex-nun, you know, not most people my age. So
right.
It's just a unique opportunity to ask questions they wouldn't otherwise get to ask.
Now, how about genderqueer?
Genderqueer, I know it means a lot of different things for a lot of people. When I say that I'm genderqueer, so that's not how other people identify, that's how I identify. It means I'm a chick that's mistaken for a dude all the time, although I'm never mistaken for a full-grown dude. I'm actually usually mistaken for a 12-year-old boy. Or recently on Fire Island, somebody told me, said, you know, you should dye your hair gray because when you talk, you sound like a bitter old queen, but you look like a fifth-grade Catholic schoolboy. Oh, well, I'll put that.
What do you say? Do you say thank you when people say things like that? I'm not sure I know what the proper response is.
Well, I guess I could. Thank you would certainly be a reasonable.
All right, we'll go with that. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
So that's genderqueer. And then my favorite, nerd comic.
Yeah, nerd comic is a word I started using. For a while I was using dork, and then somebody told me that dork isn't really used since like 1950. So I went back with nerd. But for me, you know, my niece recently made a video called Why It's Great to Be a Nerd. And one of the things she said, which was really, I thought was very interesting and kind of astute, she's 16, she said, being a nerd, it means you get to care about things. And if I see, like, kind of the common thread in nerdiness, and, like,
yeah,
people who are into Star Trek and people who are into technology and people who, I'm more of a book nerd, I guess, than a science fiction nerd, or, you know, the common thread is actually caring. You know, it's really caring about things. And
yeah.
So for me, I feel like, I mean, I was once described as kind of sickeningly earnest by a theater critic. Which is probably true. I am pretty earnest, but this is part of, like, being a nerd, right? Is that I really care about things. Things really matter. So I want to make comedy. I don't want to make comedy about, like, and then I went to this part of town, and, you know, I want to make comedy about things that kind of have greater significance.
Gotcha.
Things that I really care about. So that's kind of why I started using the nerd comic. And I also think it lets people know, you know, so many people, this thing with Daniel Tosh.
Right.
Has really brought up, you know, kind of, can you make a rape joke? Are rape jokes ever funny? And a lot of, I'm not even talking about that specific incident, but for example, one of the clubs in New York actually released a press release saying, well, like, don't come here if you don't want to be insulted. And I thought, dude, what kind of business, like, really? You know?
That's an interesting business model.
Right. The scarcity model. We don't want you here.
Yes.
Make yourself scarce. But it's an interesting, it led to some interesting conversations about stand-up comedy and why many people hate stand-up comedy.
Right.
I've done shows where I've actually said, like, the stand-up comedy show for people who take stand-up comedy. Because it's about insulting people, or it's about, you know, instead of advancing the conversation about race, it's just about being racist, right? Which are
right.
two different things, and I don't think, you know, a lot of clubs actually know that. So it kind of gives, I feel like it sends a signal to people that this is like a different kind of comedy. Even if you don't normally like comedy, you might actually like this.
You might actually like it. And we should point out, your first night, very early on doing comedy, was quite the fraught experience, was it not? Did you have a parking lot run-in of some sort?
I did, yes. Would you like to hear the parking lot run-in?
I think we all would like to hear the parking lot run-in story.
I think you already know it, so I guess it's an all thing, right? So I was performing in Philadelphia at one of the open mics at Comedy Something. I think it's called the Comedy Cabaret.
Okay.
And so it was a mainstream club, and it was a mainstream open mic. And, you know, as a comic, the way you get good is just to do comedy all the time. Do it all the time.
Right.
And so I was trying at this open mic, and I used to start my set then with I need you to, you know, ignore all the visual cues and realize that I'm an adult female and not a 12-year-old boy.
Okay.
And a dude in the audience yelled, "You're not your 12-year-old boy, you're a big, fat, ugly dyke." And before I could think, I answered, "You're just sad I'm not a 12-year-old boy, you and the Catholic priest." And he chased me in the parking lot with a broken bottle. As I was running away, I thought, I should run more. I should become a better runner.
There you go.
A faster runner. Or I should get different, I should find some different places to perform. And I decided that probably I would enjoy finding different places to perform more. So that was my decision.
Have you ever been back there?
Have I ever been back there? I don't know. I actually might have gone to that open mic again.
Yeah.
Because it was really the only, at that time, the only comedy open mic in Philadelphia.
Gotcha.
It is possible that I went back, but I definitely decided, like, oh, mainstream comedy, this is not working for me.
Now, gay audience versus straight audience. I love that we've had so many comics on the show over the years, and I had my own very disastrous turn as a stand-up comic, and the only thing that saved me is that I had a mostly gay audience. Gay audience versus straight audiences, do you see a difference? Do you prefer one over the other?
Well, I don't necessarily prefer one over the other. What you have to do is know whether it's a gay audience versus a straight audience and not, you know, before you start. And then you can tailor the material. You know, some of my jokes are very much kind of about, like, for example, I was performing at something called Dykopolis, or Dyke plus Apocalypse.
Okay.
Last week, and I just kind of spontaneously made a joke about, like, I was referencing a name of a person in the story I was telling, and I said, "Eli." And then I said, "That's not that person's name, but they're queer. They're a Brooklyn queer. It could be Eli, since most everyone's name is." And the audience laughed, right? Because it seems like Eli is the most common queer name, especially among, like, young masculine people.
Absolutely.
You know, I could have done that, made that reference with a whole room full of straight people. And even if they had some cultural exposure, they had gay friends or whatever, it's a really specific part of our subculture.
Right.
I actually had an something happened once on New Year's Eve. My friend Jessica Halem, who you should have on the show because she's fantastic.
Let's get her.
She's one of those other comics that I'm like, you know, never, like, you know, some comics, they get up and you perform with them and you feel embarrassed afterwards. Like, Jessica, her politics are great, and she's hilarious. She's really, really hilarious. You'll have to have an active beep button, I think. But anyway, so she and I like to organize shows together. And she had put together a New Year's Eve show that I was performing at. And it was at Dixon Place, which is not completely queer, but pretty queer, in the Lower East Side. And there was, like, all this silence when the comics were performing. It was, like, polite, and when they, like, they laughed a lot, but there was a lot of, like, kind of head scratching and stuff. And then halfway through, she looks at the postcard and she says, "Oh my God, I did not put gay anywhere on this postcard."
Oh my.
But I was like, yeah, because we're so gay. It's like, you know, it's like a fish telling everybody that there's going to be water present, right?
Right.
So we were performing to an entire crowd full of straight people, but we didn't know it was straight people who ended up coming, you know, to this show. So one of those things, like, I threw out my set in the middle and just started on something completely different. So it's mostly just knowing your audience and doing it long enough that you have a repertoire for kind of everyone. I mean, I, you know, for example, coming up, I'm doing a gig with, it's a nursing conference, and they're going to, the nurses are going to have spent all day, it's a mandated reporter training, which means they will have spent all day.
Oh, gosh.
Watching videos of, is this child abuse? Is this not child abuse? Do you have to call about this? Do you not have to call about this?
And then they go to the comedy show.
Right, right. And then at the end of the day, I guess so, they feel better. Their administration, which I feel like, you know, it's kind of nice that they're even thinking about this, has hired me to come in and cheer up the nurses, basically, right? So that, you know, is also a very, very unique set of circumstances. I mean,
wow.
You're never going to find a club crowd where, you know, that is the case. So I think it's really being flexible, and that just comes with experience.
This is just free advice, and you can take it or leave it. I probably wouldn't do any rape jokes that day.
I don't do any rape jokes.
Yeah. It's probably not the best day, so I'm happy they booked you and not some other comics that are out there. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, talk to me about, because I was checking this out earlier in the week, and I was quite fascinated by it. Talk to me about Grief Sucks.
Well, Grief Sucks is a relatively new project of mine. In 2007, I had a partner die of cancer, and Heather McAllister, and I, you know, after she died, I said, you know, she's the love of my life. I will never, you know, find anyone else. And,
right.
A couple of years later, I met Cheryl Burke, who I was like, wow, this is my miracle girl. You know, she just, she kind of reached in and, made herself a little place in my heart, and, it was really amazing. And she was diagnosed with cancer. She actually had Hodgkin's lymphoma, which most 87% of people who have Hodgkin's lymphoma who have a normal course of chemo are completely cured. But she had a overwhelming pulmonary reaction to the chemotherapy, the bleomycin they gave her, and she died last June.
Okay.
Pretty unexpectedly, although it was after 3 months in the hospital, but it was very unexpected that she, most people don't die of Hodgkin's. But 2 out of 100 people who have bleomycin die from it. So really, you know, related to the medical care she got. So being in kind of a unique experience of being a 44-year-old person who's lost two partners.
Right.
I should say unique right now in our current situation, right, because there are many men who've lost 2-3 partners during the AIDS epidemic. Some
right.
All their friends as well. So I should add that as well. Anyway, so I'm kind of in a unique position where I've been able to I've had like these 2 intense grief experiences, and in talking with people and in doing comedy about it, even like raises people's awareness, and people talk to me a lot about their grief experiences. And some of the things that people say that are less than helpful and some of the things that people say that are helpful. And so I started this project, and the idea is that I call it Grief Sucks, Bereavement for the Rest of Us. And it's basically an irreverent guide to grief. It's a blog, and it also has resources on it. For example, one of the resources I have is like 10 ways to ask for help for the unused to asking for help, right? Like easy ways to communicate that you need help if you need help, but you're a person who's usually really independent and doesn't want to ask other people.
Right.
And it's got some personal stories. I'm actually in the midst of working on a blog post right now called The Funeral Director is a Salesperson. And it's kind of like the nitty-gritty guide to you know, when somebody dies, especially when somebody younger dies where their arrangements haven't been made, funeral arrangements haven't been made, you know, that's a tremendous opportunity for an upsell, you know. Like, for example, my partner, her mom knew that she wanted to be cremated, but she got upsold by the funeral director into a embalming and a casket, and then she was cremated later, right, which is ridiculous. That was just about money. So even kind of like explaining for people how to talk to funeral directors, how to deal with ashes. You know, many people don't know, like when they get the ashes back, they're expecting that they're just going to be fine powder, but that's not actually what, as they say, cremains are. So it's kind of those really, really, like literally nitty-gritty stuff that people need to know about death, but that we don't talk about in our culture. And because I'm a comic, I can talk about it in a way that, you know, people, maybe it's not like belly laughs, people are like, yes, that's a wry, humorous statement about remains, you know.
Right.
So it's a way of communicating. I get the information about grief and death to people without adding more trauma to the situation, I hope. So, and communicating about grief, because that's the other thing. People really don't know what to say to you when your first partner dies. when your second partner dies, they have no
idea.
They
have no idea. I would imagine it puts you in the position where you're like, oh, I guess I got to make people feel more comfortable because they don't even know what to say to me.
Well, I think kind of it did the first time, but by the second time I was just, I was out of the business or tried to be out of the business
right.
of taking care of other people. One of the best, actually, advice that came from author Sarah Schulman, who's a close friend of Cheryl's, I was very kind of, and has been great to me. And so I was saying, like, Sarah, I just don't know what to do with this. I was like, I don't know what to do with this. Like, there's just, I want, what could I do? And she's like, Kelly, just be devastated. Just be devastated. Just shut up and be devastated. There's nothing else.
There's nothing else to do.
This level of grief. And I thought, you know, shut up and be devastated. That's pretty good advice, actually. You know, because there isn't anything. And I would say, like, when things are really bad, the only thing you can say to somebody is, I'm sorry, that sucks. That's it. Anything else, you know, your belief in the afterlife, what you believe about why people die, all that should not be shared. Just, I'm sorry, that sucks.
I'm sorry, that sucks. Let me know if you need anything.
Yes, yeah.
Just throwing that
actually
on.
Actually follow up.
Yeah. Right.
Specifics.
Not just the puff of smoke when you say, let me know if you need anything, and then running away as fast as possible.
Right. A lot of things when people are dealing with grief is they're just uncomfortable. And it's okay to feel uncomfortable. I wouldn't expect that. I would be like, oh, Kelly's second partner died. Oh, I feel totally. Yeah, that's, oh, you know, let's talk about that. Of course people feel uncomfortable. I would expect them to. But actually, discomfort is not, discomfort doesn't kill us. You know?
Right.
I think our, so that's, if you can just kind of sit with the discomfort and say like, oh, this is really, wow. But, you know. So that's, I think, a lot of what people's reactions are.
That's a great site. I'm looking forward to more posts on there. Well, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do a little social justice work, too, even though I know you already do some. I'm currently living in a town where skateboarding is illegal. What do you have to say to the community here in Brattleboro, Vermont, about skateboarding?
So it's completely illegal?
It's like Footloose. Well, it's illegal. You can't skateboard on the sidewalks and whatnot in downtown Brattleboro.
Well, then have they built a skate park? I would say, like, you know, the skateboarders need to get together and, like, say, like, you know, in Portland, there's a skateboarder park, a skate park made by skaters. They just, like, kind of petition the city. I know it's Portland, but, oh, come on, how different are Vermont and Portland?
No, we are in the process of building a skate park, but no one, I learned all about NIMBYism. A lot of people don't, they're like, oh, yeah, we totally support the skate park, just not in my backyard.
Right. Well, one thing is I think, like, when they put up noise walls, because the sound of, like, skateboard wheels, actually, they do kind of, they echo a lot, right? Especially if there's, like, bowls and things like that. So
right.
Even just putting up, noise walls can help with that sound. But.
So horrible things don't happen when skateboarders congregate, is what you're saying.
Sometimes they don't happen. I don't think it's, I don't think it's, like, a, you know, a sure thing. I think we're supposed to be
allaying the fears here, Kelly.
Oh, well, I just don't want to say a universal statement of nothing bad has ever happened when a skateboarder got...
Oh, I'm totally fine with that for this show.
I'm just saying, I think when teenagers don't have enough to do, terrible things happen. I
there
you agree
go.
With that as a statement.
There you go. We're just trying to get the Kelly Dunham endorsement of the skate park.
Of course.
Now, you have so many things coming up. Where can folks go to learn all about the cool things that you're doing? I feel like you have 14 different websites. Is 14 accurate?
Well, the you know, my main site where everything is linked to and everything is on is KellyDunham.com, Kelly with an I, Dunham.com. And I have, yes, I'm on, like, all social media, Facebook, Twitter. Everything is Kelly Dunham. Very clever, I know. But KellyDunham.com also has my calendar. It's pulled in from Reverb Nation, but you can get, like, all my upcoming gigs. And also, people can sign up for, if they sign up for my mailing list, which is no more than 2 emails a month at most, they'll also get access to a free download of my bit about Widow Camp,
okay,
which is not actually publicly available yet. It's on the new CD that's coming out. Freak of Nurture, but that's not coming out till September. So if they sign up for my email list, they actually will get something that's not released to the public yet.
So Freak of Nurture is the next CD, and that's coming out soon.
Yeah, in September.
Very exciting. Do we have big plans? Will there be parties? What's going to happen?
Well, I don't have the location for this, and this is, like, the first time I'm publicly announcing it. I don't have a venue yet. In September, I'm going to be doing a the Freak of Nurture, you know, release party. But what it's going to be is, it's going to be Freak of Nurture, we're all in this together, and it's going to be a celebration of friendship in the LGBT community. And I don't have all the details worked out, but the performances and are all going to be about this celebration of friendship, you know. I think with the emphasis and the time we're spending fighting for marriage, I think sometimes that we're forgetting that we're not just couples, we're also a community. And so I really want us to take time to celebrate the friendships, these deep friendships.
Yeah.
You know, I have a best friend of 15 years. She is my longest relationship by far. You know, I always tell her, you are forbidden from dying. And she's like, ever? I can never die? And I'm like, no, you are never allowed to die. So these are like amazing transformative friendships. We are family to each other. And I want to have an opportunity for people to celebrate that. So there's going to be performances. And, of course, the CD will be there for the first time. But there's also going to be some kind of, I don't know, group commitment ceremony as well. Not where we'll all end up like married or domestic partner to each other. But, like, you know, kind of recommitting to our friendships and remembering how important they are in our lives.
I love that. More celebration of our friendships. We could use that.
Yeah, and for myself, I know I have no question. I mean, I'm very active, like, the widow world online. And, you know, most people my age who have lost husbands and who are, don't have the benefit of being in either a close-knit, like, church community or whatever, don't have nearly the support that I do. I've been so grateful for the huge amounts of support that I've gotten through both my experiences and also my partner when they were ill, you know. And that's an amazing, it's a transformative, I don't want to say it's a miracle, but it is, sure is amazing compared to the rest of the world. So it's also, I'm so grateful for that. So I want us to kind of celebrate really that exists.
You know? I love that. I love that idea. All right, so folks are going to have to check that out and keep your eyes open for Freak of Nurture and sign up for the list, and you'll get free content. And I'm looking right now. All of these performances in New York City, so there are ample opportunities to see Kelly Dunham. I love your career journey. I love that you have multiple passions and that you are putting yourself out there as just an authentic voice, except for that one guy's aunt. So I think that maybe hyphens would be maybe not the worst thing in the world, but love that you are using your voice to just put yourself out there. That's what this show is all about. Kelly Dunham, you're going to keep doing this?
Absolutely I am. And also I just want to clarify, a lot of my upcoming gigs are in New York, but I'm actually doing a Midwestern tour, much like my Southern tour, where it's kind of performing in small community places or house concerts. So people should contact me if they're in the Midwest and want to have a concert and think like, oh, we couldn't bring in a comic, because I'm going to be doing it on the bus. We can do donations. We can do sliding scales.
Love it. And you will be performing, well, let's put it in stone right now. You'll be performing at the opening of the Brattleboro Skate Park next year.
Right, exactly. I will totally be there, and I might even do a 360 while I'm performing.
That is now here on our 175th episode. You guys heard it first, and you will all tune in for that next year. Kelly Dunham. And
I know all the skaters will be like, oh, really? Just a 360? But whatever. I'm 44.
I will pay to see it. I will pay to see it. Kelly Dunham, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. We are so excited to see you do more.
All right, thanks. It was great to talk to you.
All the best.
Every time I feel this way, this familiar sinking, I will lay my troubles down by the water where the river will never run dry. Hallelujah. So take from me these troubles, bring me sweet release where the river will never run.
Folks, we have a few minutes left, so we will get some news coming at you real quick. First, a little bit of clarification, because I have received a ton of emails from you listeners saying, what is wrong with you, Ken? Why do you support Chick-fil-A? I can't believe you support Chick-fil-A. Stop supporting Chick-fil-A. I promise you, I do not support Chick-fil-A. I was just mentioning on the show last week with Jody during our news segment that perhaps in my youth, so long ago in New Jersey at Paramus Park, right there in Paramus, New Jersey, Bergen County, that perhaps I would go up to that food court and enjoy a Chick-fil-A sandwich. I do not support their politics, but I kind of miss eating Chick-fil-A, although I really don't, because again, I'm a vegetarian who hasn't had fast food in about a decade, so it is what it is. But the Chick-fil-A fallout just continues to happen from the maker of the Muppets to the mayor of Boston. There are a lot of folks who are addressing Chick-fil-A's very kind of proud admission that, yes, we discriminate against gay people. We are against gay marriage as an entire fast food chain. So first it was the Jim Henson Company, and they were working with Chick-fil-A to come up with, I guess, Chick-fil-A's version of Happy Meal products where you build different characters or something like that. And the Jim Henson Company put out this statement, quote, "The Jim Henson Company has celebrated and embraced diversity and inclusiveness for over 50 years, and we have notified Chick-fil-A that we do not wish to partner with them on any future endeavors. Lisa Henson, our CEO, is personally a strong supporter of gay marriage and has directed us to donate the payment we received from Chick-fil-A to GLAAD, an advocacy group for lesbian, gay, and transgender people." So that's the Jim Henson Company cutting ties from a company all the way to an entire city. Boston Mayor Thomas Menino, he said in an interview with the Boston Herald, he vowed to block the chain from opening up shop in his city, promising to make it extremely difficult for the company to procure the required licenses. He said, quote, "Chick-fil-A doesn't belong in Boston. You can't have a business in the city of Boston that discriminates against a population. We're an open city. We're a city that's at the forefront of inclusion." And nearly 4,000 people have signed that Boston pledge to boycott Chick-fil-A. Audra McDonald, who I adore, who has like 12 Tonys and she's just 40 years old, she said, quote, "Not that I ate much Chick-fil-A before, but I show enough don't have an appetite for it now." So that's Audra. Well, I love Audra McDonald. I just started watching Private Practice. She's very enjoyable in that. And actor Ed Helms, he tweeted a similar comment. But, of course, you can't put yourself out there like Chick-fil-A has and say you're against gay marriage without picking up some endorsements. And one endorsement that they picked up was former presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. On his Facebook page last weekend, he's the former Arkansas governor, he wrote that he is, quote, "been incensed at the vitriolic assaults on the Chick-fil-A company." He called the people who own it a wonderful Christian family who are committed to operating a company with biblical principles, there's that phrase again, and whose story is the true American success story, one that is being smeared by vicious hate speech and intolerant bigotry from the left. He has declared, this is the best part. Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate, this is where his priorities are. He declared August 1st, Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. He said, quote, "Too often those on the left make corporate statements to show support for same-sex marriage, abortion, or profanity, but if Christians affirm traditional values, we're considered homophobic, fundamentalists, hate-mongers, and intolerant." So now he has declared August 1st, not, you know, National Adoption Day, or although I'm sure there is one already, or some other kind of cause that perhaps helps a ton of people. No, he's declaring it Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. So the Chick-fil-A debate continues on. Please don't write me thinking that I support Chick-fil-A. I don't. It's just in my youth I enjoyed a sandwich or two. That's all I'm saying. Now, over in Washington, D.C. right now, I know I have a ton of friends who are in D.C. right this second because it is indeed the 19th International AIDS Conference. So that started last Sunday, and there's a ton of speeches. Now, along with this conference and the workshops, there have been a nice influx, as well there should be, of articles about HIV and AIDS. And one of them you have to go check out. It's in the Washington Post. It's online, and you can just Google the name, I'm sure, or just go to Washington Post, WashingtonPost.com, and type in the phrase, AIDS remains a problem, but is it still a priority for the gay community? And it's by Daniel Teets, and it was published on July 20th, and it is an amazing read, so I highly recommend you to check out that article. He writes, in the 1980s, AIDS ravaged gay communities across the country. Gay and bisexual men of all races, classes, and walks of life were falling ill, dying, or attending their friends' funerals every week. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Even while this crisis has grown, help in combating it has been shrinking. HIV no longer seems to be a priority for some in the gay community. Foundations focused on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, which have historically provided millions of dollars and crucial funding for HIV service organizations, are shifting their resources elsewhere. The fight is different now. And so that's just a brief portion of this article called, this op-ed called, AIDS Remains a Problem, But Is It Still a Priority for the Gay Community? Go check it out. And of course, all the drama, as it always is going down in the comments section. And I'm always interested, you know, whatever. There's always going to be some conservative folks who pop into a comment section because they have a Google alert for the word gay and they got to pop in. But I'm always kind of interested by divisions within the LGBT community, particularly on HIV and AIDS. And there are certainly some different opinions expressed, some intolerance for some of our brothers and sisters who they feel are just not doing their part to stem epidemics. It's really quite an interesting read and always gives you kind of a nice capture of what's going on in the community. So go check that out on WashingtonPost.com. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of our 175th episode of This Show Is So Gay. A pleasure as always. We love hearing from you. Even if you want to write me and say, I know you really like Chick-fil-A and support their stances, that's fine. I love hearing from you guys. Take a couple seconds, write an email, send it on to ken@thisshowisogay.com. You got to stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com and learn about our guests for upcoming shows, listen to past shows. You can go all the way back 174 episodes and listen to our first ever episode on our website. It is, it's terrible. It's not good. Becca and I did not know what we were doing. The sound levels are off. But even, you know, 174 episodes later, we still have sound problems. So it happens. We just love doing what we do. So you can do that. And of course, go to the Facebook. And I love that there are all these huge influx of people who are liking our page. So go on there, type in The Show So Gay on Facebook, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun show coming at you next week. Some really unique guests who are doing some really great things. And so you must tune in. There will be a reverend. There will be a representative from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. We have really a great show for you planned next week. So tune in next week for that. And with that, I got to get out of here. So have an amazing week. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference in this world. And of course, while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Where do you go with your broken heart and soul? Where does the good go? Where does the good go?